I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study. I'm very pleased to have on my program today Dr. Christian Sherry. Dr. Sherry obtained his MD in 1985 and read for his PhD in molecular genetics and obtained it in 1998. He was actually the first PhD from the Faculty of Medicine here at the University of Malta. At present, he is consultant at Mater Dei Hospital. That's his sort of full-time job, and he does some part-time lecturing here at the University of Malta. His research interests are mainly, obviously, in molecular genetics, mainly in thalassemia and celiac disease. Dr. Sherry also chairs the Association of the European Celiac Societies. He's married to Josiane, who is also a lecturer in the university in health and psychology, and they have three children and a dog.
And a dog.
Welcome, Dr. Sherry.
Yeah, welcome to you and your and to whoever is hearing us on the on this program.
The word thalassemia has cropped up in various interviews over the years with regard to research matters, with obviously Professor Felice. Your particular input into this kind of research, what would it be? What would it concern?
One of the pioneers, basically, because we started working with in molecular genetics in around 1989, 1990, where basically it was really the first small seed in molecular genetics in Malta. When I came here in the lab, there was practically nothing. The lab, our labs, our two labs, were in fact used as stores. So literally with Professor Felice, he came here first from Georgia, and I followed him up in the lab, and our first year or so was basically cleaning the lab and trying to get a couple of equipment from here and there, or building our own. So it was an exciting time when basically we were there. So the first disorder that we looked at from the molecular side, we thought of thalassemia, thalassemia being a Mediterranean condition, quite common in Malta, plus that Alex had done a lot of work on thalassemia and other similar disorders back in Georgia and the US, so he brought up this knowledge with him. And in fact, we started off with thalassemia. We started off with a screening program in the in Malta, which is still ongoing. And my thesis, my primary work, was the characterization of the thalassemia condition in Malta from the molecular point of view. So we can also say that it was the first disease, genetic disease, that was fully characterized in Malta. I mean, we know all the mutations that there are, we know the percentages, we know how to test them, and now from that work, we're using that work now to give a service, so this is now part of the service. So that is my input in the thalassemia. From there, as you said, now there are a number of people working within the field. They've moved away from just looking at genes. Now we're looking at also how these genes are controlled and how we can change the control. That's the present studies on thalassemia is basically on that area, how to control genes. As you might know, thalassemia is a condition where the person has lack of hemoglobin, so has anemia. And if we had to look at our hemoglobin as we're growing up, we don't have one hemoglobin when we are as an embryo or as a fetus, in fact. In the womb, we have a fetal hemoglobin. When we are born, that fetal hemoglobin is switched off, and we have an adult hemoglobin. The color is still the same, the function is still the same, but the protein is different. Now, thalassemia affects only the adult. So if we had to find a way how to switch on back our fetal hemoglobin, then it's a way of treating these patients. That's basically one of the ideas. And this is a work that is being done, and there are also some possible breakthroughs that we are seeing which we'll be able to reveal and speak about most probably within a couple of months.
Yes, because of course there's the kind of research work I would imagine that you do, where you're looking into the disease, trying to discover it from every aspect of its, as you say, mutations and all the things that go to make up the disease itself. And then there must be this other side where you're sort of looking at the results that you've got with the possibility of, you know, dare one say it, a cure.
No, in fact, I mean, our aim from the American Genetic side are two. One is the diagnosis. I mean, most of these disorders are difficult to diagnose, or they are diagnosed late. So by knowing the mutations and also how these mutations together work, you can get an early diagnosis, which is useful. Then the second option, which is also an option that interests a lot of people, because the diagnosis it's interesting only from the counseling point of view, mostly in the beginning, because you can counsel couples at risk of these conditions in what they can do. So that's only in counseling. So you're not really effectively doing anything that is going to change the future of that couple. On the other hand, there are people that have children, and these children have these disorders, and their interest then now becomes treatment. So with the knowledge that we have of the mutations, the knowledge that we have of the physiology that's happening in the cell, then we can work out, or other people can work out, in fact, pharmaceutical treatments to target that particular disease. So yes, that is the second phase, and in most of these, in thalassemia at least, we have arrived in the second phase. In some other disorders, we're still early in discovery, the genes.
Thalassemia, of course, is something that just affects Malta. There are other island peoples within the Mediterranean. So I presume you must have a network of other researchers and people working in the field with whom you deal.
The word thalassemia started as a word, means thalassemia. And thalass is the White Sea, the Central Sea. So it's a word that indicates the Mediterranean. So initially, this was identified in people of Mediterranean origin. So Italians, Greeks, North Africans, Cypriots. But nowadays, or after a certain time, it was also discovered that this disease crosses the globe, especially in the old world. So we find this disorder in the Middle East, in the area of Iran and Iraq, in India, Southeast Asia, and basically it's wherever there was malaria, or wherever malaria was endemic. And the reason being that carriers of thalassemia or even similar conditions like sickle cell have got some protection against malaria. So in this case, these people were stronger, and they could have more children. So that gene increased in the pool. Nowadays, because of immigration, thalassemia is present in Germany, in Holland, and in the UK, in America, because a lot of people, I mean, coming from these areas, have emigrated to these countries. So it's a main problem within ethnic groups, also within these countries that normally did not have thalassemia. So normally their knowledge of thalassemia is lacking. So yes, it's a large community. There's an international foundation, and there's an international federation of associations, the TIF. Plus, there's a good network in research. In fact, we are also part of a research program under a European-funded program called ETANET, which is basically Thalassemia Net, International Thalassemia Net. That's ETANET, and it's a network where we use modern technologies like webcasting, like video conferencing, to meet and discuss our project and also prepare proposals for future projects. I can say that there's a big network.
The other area that you're interested in, of course, is celiac disease. This is a word that has, in my experience anyway, sort of come up in the last few years, and it's really become quite well known as a disease. Is there some reason why it's become better known now than it was before?
That's to maybe say, what is celiac disease? Celiac disease is a condition in which the person has an intolerance to gluten. Now, gluten is a protein found in a number of cereals. So for the Maltese population, the most important ones are wheat and barley. So gluten is present in wheat and barley. Its main use in the food industry is to glue, gluten, to glue stuff. So you have a particular mechanism in which the food becomes glued. Now, in the case of a person suffering from the condition, this gluten, this piece of gluten, in fact, of the protein, triggers an immunity reaction, triggers a reaction that is usually a reaction directed for a foreign body. So we have in our body, we have white cells that kill off bacteria and kill off viruses, our soldiers. Now, in this case, this gluten triggers such a reaction, but this reaction becomes directed towards ourselves. So it's an autoimmune disease. And when it comes directed against ourselves, what it does is it flattens our intestinal tract. What do we mean by flattening? I always like to give this example. We have in our intestinal tract, our small intestines, we have around 8 meters, or in the old terminology, 24 feet of intestinal tract. And if you had to open it up, split it up, make it flat, you get maybe a width of around, let's say, 10 centimeters, even less. So if you had to put all these intestinal tracts, all these 8 meters, next to each other, to have to say an area, you might get an area similar or slightly bigger than a normal coffee table. Not much. Now, from this area, we need our food has to be absorbed, all of it. So the larger your area, the more is your absorption. Now, a coffee table size is not enough. We don't get enough absorption. So the body does a trick. If we had to look under a microscope, you find small hills on the surface. So these small hills are increasing your surface area. And these are called villi and microvilli, because they are even smaller than that. Now, so if I had to really flatten this mucosa, so make it flat, the area from a coffee table becomes quite similar to a basketball court. That's the increase in size. Now, when you get a celiac condition, the white cells, our white cells, are attacking the microvilli and the villi. So we end up with a flattened mucosa. That's why we call it a flattened mucosa, because there are no hills. From a basketball court, we end up again to our coffee table. So the main condition is a condition in which absorption is not up to scratch. So you get food remaining in the intestinal tract, which gives a diarrhea type of symptom. The food that remains in the intestinal tract, the bacteria will act on it, and you get a bloated feeling. The person will not grow well. So in childhood, there is what we call a failure to thrive, a failure to grow. And then there is also significant malnutrition. So even though he's eating all the possible food, but it's not like his nutrients, so lack of calcium, lack of iron. And basically the picture is a picture of malnutrition, of a child that is suffering from malnutrition, as if he's not eating well. Now, this was the classical cases. So when I might taste as a student in the 1885, celiac disease, when it was mentioned, because it was thought to be very rare in this area, I mean, it was thought to be very common in Ireland, it was thought to be an Irish disease, but very rare in the other parts of the world. We used to mention it as a childhood disease, as a pediatric disease, with these symptoms. And at that time, it was even more difficult to diagnose, because the only way you can diagnose it was by being clinically aware of it and a biopsy. And that is, you put an instrument down the mouth into the small intestinal tract, and you take a piece of tissue and look at it under the microscope. That is the biopsy. Then, the last 20 years or so, we had a revolution in the sense that we got a blood test for celiac disease. So now we could test antibodies for gliadin, and nowadays there are more, and we could identify possible cases. And within the last 20 years, there was an explosion of cases, because now we have noticed that around 70% of the cases do not appear at childhood, do not have the gastrointestinal symptoms, or such an overt gastrointestinal symptoms. And most of these cases now are diagnosed either because you have iron deficiency, that is not being able, I mean, that whilst whilst you treat with iron, with an iron supplement, it does not improve. So basically, a resistant iron deficiency, or else osteoporosis. So your bones become thin and not strong, or else various other symptoms like migraines, epileptic fit, chest pains, allergies on the skin. Or there are people that have no apparent symptoms, or they are depressed with depression. So there are so many symptoms now. I mean, last week we had a meeting here in Malta, a medical meeting and the society's meeting. And in one of these medical meeting, there was this foreign speaker who decided to list the symptoms of celiac disease. And he put up on the screen a whole slide that when you look at it, you could say it's one big paragraph of words. So it could be anything. So the explosion, really, there were two possible reasons for the explosion. One, because we were diagnosing more cases because of the serology. The other explosion was possibly due to two factors. One is a different type of nutrition in childhood. We know that in the last 40 years, there was a move from breastfeeding to artificial feeds. And initially, the artificial feeds for these babies contained also gluten. And this was identified in Sweden, where they had the celiac epidemic. And I noticed that this coincided when there was this move from breastfeeding to artificial feeds. And it seems that breastfeeding protects against celiac disease, as well as the entry point of gluten in the diet. So these two are interrelated. So there could be really an explosion because of this cause. The second reason is that we have become too clean. Now this seems to be a strange
contradiction.
Contradiction, yes. But it seems that because in childhood we're not getting a lot of infectious disorders, especially of the intestinal tract, we are now suffering from autoimmune disease. And this could be the reason for diabetes in the young ones, as well as asthma. It's just that the body soldiers need to attack something. It's like a mutiny. They have nothing to do. They are going to attack, and they attack us. So this clean theory, it exists. It's been it cannot be proven 100%, but it could be very well that.
So now you have this test for celiac, which has made it easier to make an early diagnosis. Yes. I presume that you've reached the stage of creating some kind of medicine to help out with it, or not?
Unfortunately, not yet. Mm. Just to put in some figures, nowadays it is thought that celiac disease is present in at least 1 in 100. So it's 1% in Europe. In some cases, for example, the last figure that I've seen in Finland and in the UK, it has been even gone down to 1 in 80. So it is a major disorder. Unfortunately, there is no treatment. The treatment for celiac disease is a gluten-free diet. So basically, I use the word unfortunately. I can assure you, I had 3 days last week where all the food was gluten-free. And most probably I increased a kilo or so in these 3 days. I mean, you could eat a lot of food that is gluten-free, so it's not unfortunate from that point of view. But obviously, it's a special food. It needs a special... one has to be careful that he doesn't contaminate the food with the normal food. It's not cheap. And it might be difficult to find when you go for, parties or weddings in this area. So that is the unfortunate part. So yes, it would be good to find a drug. But nowadays, finding a drug also means finding the cause of celiac disease. So we know a lot about celiac disease in the last 20 years, but we are still far away from finding the cause. Genetically, we are finding every year a number of genes that are important to give you the disorder. This is different from thalassemia. Thalassemia was quite easy, because thalassemia, one disease, one gene, one disease. Here we're speaking about multifactorial disorders, like diabetes, ischemic heart disease, in which you have a number of genes that play a part, some of them an important part. For example, in celiac disease, the HLA type, that is the HLA type, is a protein on our cell that shows the other cells what is self and what is FFO, what is the enemy. Now, HLA type in sea disease is very important. Around 50% of the genetic makeup that makes the acidic condition is due to a type of HLA. It's called DQ2, DQ8. But this type, which is called that, is not the only one, because 30% of the population carries this type of HLA. But on the other hand, only 1% has the disease. So there must be other genes involved. So on calculation, this is responsible for around 40 to 50% of the genetic. So there's another 50% then made up of tens of genes. Till now we have found most probably around 22 or 23 genes that has some responsibility in certain population, in certain cases, for celiac disease. The idea is that once we find these genes, and also maybe finding the important pathways, then we can target a drug, a sort of a silver bullet, targeted for that particular gene or that particular pathway, and that is your treatment.
I remember speaking to other medical researchers, and they have mentioned the fact that having this Maltese population that is sort of an enclosed population has its advantages as far as studies are concerned, not necessarily genetic studies, but all sorts of studies, even economic studies. And so I presume that for genetic studies it would be useful as well to have this particular pool.
Yes, that is one thing that we identified from our single gene disorders, from thalassemia and the others that we have studied. We found what we call founder effects. Now, founder is a founder, somebody that brought the population to Malta. And from the history, if I had to look at the history, because it's important to look at the history, one finds that, in fact, the population of Malta had very low numbers in the 11th century to early 16th century. We're speaking about numbers in the range of 5,000, 7,000, to a maximum of 17,000 in 1530. And the Knights of Malta, when they came over, they brought with them around 3,000 persons. So they got a genetic input of around 1/6, which is important. And then during their first 100 years or so, they started getting immigration from Italy as workers, as builders to build the palaces, as sailors, etc. And that was another input. So in fact, when we come to the early 19th century, that is 1800-something, we find that the population went up from 17,000 to 100,000. So our population has a high number of founder effects. Our population has also large families confined in a small space, so it's not difficult for them to come over to hospital or somebody goes to their house. These we don't find in larger countries. Larger countries, usually families are spread throughout the whole place. It's very difficult to get them over. It's expensive, etc. So our families and our population is very useful to identify new genes within disorders. That's exactly what we have done in celiac condition. I mean, around 5-6 years ago, we started a research, and we started picking up or collecting cases, and we collected around 100 celiac cases with their families as well as their data. And then from these 100, we picked up one family made up of around 17 individuals, and within it had 6 or 7 cases of celiac disease. So it was a very interesting family, had 3 generations, and we looked at the genes of this family. In fact, we looked at the whole DNA. We did what is called a DNA screening, a genomic screening. And the way we inherit our genes, we inherit them together. We don't inherit a single gene. Genes, I always have this in mind. Genes are really very similar to recipes. And if you have a lot of recipes, you file them. So you have the files, and then the files, you put them in filing cabinets. When we inherit these genes from our parents, we don't inherit the single recipes, but we inherit parts of filing cabinets. So genes that are very near to each other are usually inherited together. And this is a very useful trick to use to identify new genes. Because basically, if I have 3 generations, let's say a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter with celiac disease, and I look at their genes and I see how are these genes transmitted. And I see that a block of genes are transmitted to the persons that have got celiac disease, but are not transmitted in the persons that do not have celiac disease. So by inference, I can say, okay, so in that particular part, I might have a gene that is important for celiac disease. So the trick then is, see what genes there are. Now with the Human Genome Project, we know that. See which genes have got an activity with the autoimmune disorder. And then look at those genes, sequence those genes. And this is exactly what we have done. And in this particular family, we found this gene, the CD59, which was not reported anywhere else with celiac disease. And this gene has been linked directly with the celiac condition, especially in those individuals that had the DQ2, DQ8 HLA type. So in this family, we had three types of individuals, those that were DQ2, DQ8 positive, but without the gene, and they were normal. Those that had the gene, but not the DQ2, DQ8, and they were normal also. And those that had it both and had the disorder. And this seems to have caused some stir, because it was also reported in the international news. It was quite a nice and surprise in a way, and publicity, because it was reported as a new gene therapy or possible gene therapy for celiac disease. I mean, this was reported. I didn't know about it. I mean, I searched for some reason or other. I was abroad and wanted to search for my paper. I put my name and the paper, and up came this news. So I was surprised in noticing it.
Mm.
So yes, this is the usefulness of this population, and that's what we are trying to sell. Hopefully by next year, we shall be having a revamped lab. We have a 4.5 million now euros worth of grant to change our lab, making it more modern. Our lab is now 10 years old. I mean, the last changes we had was in 2000. So
10 years is a long time in the laboratory.
In our case, 6 months is a long time almost. So 10 years, you can imagine. But by next year, we should be having a state-of-the-art lab, in which we should be, and that's our aim, to approach other countries across the Mediterranean, but even in Europe, to invite their researchers to come and use our labs. And that way we increase our network, and we also increase our collaboration, hopefully.
Well, Dr. Sherry, thank you very, very much for coming to on Campus FM to talk to us about thalassemia, about celiac, and about how your research is done. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest today was Dr. Christian Sherry. I do hope you can join us again next week for another edition of Research Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.